Welcome to Community Forum, a weekly call-in program produced at the studios of KSKA. Opinions expressed are those of the guest, host, and callers, and do not represent the views of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. And now, the host of Community Forum, Nellie Moore.
Good afternoon. It's a fantastic day in South Central Alaska. Did I just blow your ears off there? My guest today is getting around the community, and he is now here in the studio with us, Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin. How are you today?
I'm doing fine, Nellie. Thank you.
Did I get your name right?
You did this time.
I'm not even going to try to remember what I used to always call you by accident. We're talking budget today, and I have my electric scissors here with me, and he said that he wants to borrow those maybe later on if we get some good suggestions. And that's what we're going to be talking about. Of course, as you may have heard or read the paper, there's a lot of talk about the budget that's out now from the governor, and the capital and operating budgets are out, and that's what we're going to talk about. We're taking your calls and questions if you have suggestions. And first of all, can people look at the budget on the internet?
I'm pretty sure that it's up on the state website. Check at the governor's site, mm-hmm. and should be a link into the budget.
And so people could take a look at all their favorite programs, or they could peruse it to make suggestions on programs they think we should get rid of or cut back.
Yep.
So I'm going to
It's a very, very transparent process.
I was just saying, I've heard you on so many radio shows, I think this is probably a record. But
well,
that's good.
That's a good year to be talking about the budget just because of the changes in the revenue mm-hmm. situation, and folks are paying close attention to it on just how it spills out on the whole national story of the economy.
Yeah. And we're going to get to that. But first of all, I want to give out the phone number. This is a live call-in program if you're listening in the afternoon. Our number is 550-8433. That's 550-8433. Or our toll-free is 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. Or email at communityforum@kska.org. Nutshell time, we're on radio, so give us an overview of the budgets.
Sure. As I mentioned, given the revenue situation that we have, oil prices dropping tremendously in the past 6 months, the governor has responded with a budget that spends less money than last year, or actually when we talk about this year, next year, it's kind of confusing. The budget that she rolled out was the budget for the fiscal year 2010, which begins this coming July.
Mm-hmm.
And so that officially is next year, but that's the budget that the legislature will be dealing with this coming session. And the governor is proposing to reduce the spending from the current fiscal year by 7%, both on the overall size of the budget as well as just from the general fund. And the budget is intended to focus on the essential state services, focus again on safety, health, education, and invest in the resource development projects, those capital projects that we need to sustain our resource development economy. What we have the benefit of in terms of maintaining a certain amount of stability with our budget, even with the revenue going up and down so drastically, is the fact that we have lived within our means over the last couple of years, and we've socked away a tremendous amount of money in our savings accounts in order to be able to keep from panicking during these times when we're at the low end, hopefully the low end of the trough. And what we're expecting over the course of the next 18 months is oil prices to recover to a more stable level, and for the revenue to come back up but still be lower than what we've had for the last couple of years. And so we need to maintain that discipline, reduce the size of overall government, and live within our means and save when we can.
Mm-hmm. It seemed like when the last budget came out, there were some big changes, revenue sharing, education. So wasn't that a larger budget than the previous year, the previous fiscal year? I'm talking about 2009.
Yes, we had seen an increase over the last number of years, mm-hmm. Both in terms of the operating budget as well as the capital budget. The capital budget in particular had grown over the last couple of years because we were in those times of tremendous revenue over and above what we needed mm-hmm. to sustain that particular year. So we were investing in additional infrastructure and other community projects that had come up on the priority lists. What we have this year is stripping away a number of those capital projects to just what we need to invest in now to keep the essential projects going forward, and then looking at our operating budget and, again, keeping that under control, moving some of the savings around to some of the new projects like the governor's initiative with regard to health care for younger Alaskans
mm-hmm.
and
the
Denali Kid Care mm-hmm. and the preschool programs. So those programs are being funded primarily out of the savings from other programs that are finding efficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
And so rather than seeing a growth, what we're seeing is just a shifting and a maintaining of the overall size of the operating budget. The operating budget is increasing by 2%, but that represents actually a decrease when you look at the real dollars, given that inflation is roughly about 4%. So the actual services that are being provided is staying relatively the same. We're shifting into some, reprioritizing some areas
mm-hmm.
and trying to maintain discipline over the overall budget.
And what are some of the biggies in the capital budget?
Well, the capital budget is focused primarily on those infrastructure projects that go towards resource development, and the key in resource development these days is looking forward towards a gas pipeline.
Mm-hmm.
And with that project and the scope and magnitude of that project, we're going to have to make some investments today to move forward with some of the road and other transportation infrastructure that are going to need to be in place when construction begins. And so what we see is the capital budget being focused in those areas, also looking at continuing the Village Safe Water programs and various other municipal water and sewer programs, and also a continuation of the renewable energy fund that the legislature started up last year and keeping those projects going. There was a expectation that there would be $50 million put in each of the next 5 years to fully fund that program, and we're continuing that in this budget as well. There's also money within the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to keep the weatherization program going
mm-hmm.
and continue some of the things that we've seen as positive steps moving forward.
Now, it's really hard, as you said earlier, to talk about this without the context of the entire world economy at this point. Our revenues, as most people know, are driven by oil. And the price of oil, of course, has taken a big drop in the last few weeks. And where are we at right now as far as oil price today?
Well, the oil price today is roughly around $40. It's dipped below and then come back up. When I came in here, it would just about crested over 40 again.
Mm-hmm.
So we've been down there for the last couple of weeks, but it's been this precipitous drop since beginning in about September. And what we don't know is, I think most people think that we've hit more than the bottom and we're probably rebounding at this point. The market probably is overcorrected from some of the shocks to the system that it experienced over the last couple months, but we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah.
A lot of it depends, as you mentioned, on the global economy. Are we facing any sort of a domino effect with the various economic issues that both the U.S. is experiencing and some of the other developing nations, or are we seeing the beginning of a recovery given the fairly unprecedented amount of governmental intervention to try to stave off a long-term economic failure? We are hoping that those actions prove to be successful and that we begin to see the signs of a recovery.
Mm-hmm.
With economies, you end up your information lags. We just found out last month that we've been in a recession since the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
So hopefully what we'll see here in the next few months is that we've begun some form of a recovery, at least a stabilization. And then we'll probably see oil prices rebound in response to that.
Mm-hmm. And now the budget, as I understand, was developed on oil being at about $71 a barrel. Is that right?
71 is what the governor's budget approximately would be based upon. The revenue forecast that we came out with about a week ago was expecting a price at $74. Mm-hmm. And so the governor's budget actually comes in below what we're currently projecting as the revenue for fiscal year 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But we're going, you know, the budget process is a process, and we're at the very beginning of that process right now with the fall forecast and then the governor's initial budget. As we go through the legislative process, there will be more information coming with regard to oil price expectations, and then ultimately the budget for FY 2010 will be based upon a spring forecast that will come out in about 4 or 5 months.
Mm-hmm. And we do need to talk about the gas line, but I want to talk a little more about some other things first.
Okay.
Give us a call if you have questions. Our number is 550-8433. Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin is here in the studio for Community Forum this afternoon. If you're listening in the evening, you cannot call in because the program has been pre-recorded. Afternoon, we're live, toll-free, 1-888-353-5752. That's email at communityforum@kska.org. Commissioner, what other revenues get poured in the pot for the state budget?
Well, we have
federal.
Yeah, you have a variety of revenues beyond, I don't know which categories you're referring to. You've got the general fund, you've mm-hmm. got program receipt authority fees and licenses and things that are dedicated to particular expenditures that
which would be like cigarette taxes. Is that what, fees?
Well, that's more along the lines of like DEC, Department of Environmental Conservation has fees associated with their permitting, and those
okay.
fees are directly paying for the jobs associated with processing those permits.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are a number of fish and game licenses and so forth. Those fees get fed into a preordained expenditure. So when we talk about the budget, most of the focus is on the general fund, which in our language is referred to as the unrestricted general fund, because there are no restrictions, no preordained uses for it. A lot of the federal money, in fact, almost all of the federal money that we receive is restricted in some way,
mm-hmm.
dedicated to a particular purpose. And so those aren't available to the legislature to use as they see fit
mm-hmm.
in any particular year.
Even the earmarks.
Even those earmarks, especially those earmarks.
Yeah.
The focus, though, when you get to the legislative budget process is on that unrestricted general fund, because that's what they can use at their discretion.
Mm-hmm.
And so while we talk about $11.2 billion as the overall budget,
mm-hmm.
there's only $4.9 billion that is in that general fund unrestricted that the legislature can use as they see fit.
Okay. And then the capital budget came in at about $307.
Sounds about right.
And let's see. Now, what happens now? Does it go to a public process and then to the legislature, or what is the process now for the budget? When can people take a look at it and then comment on specifics?
Well, it is all part of a legislative process. The legislature has the power of appropriation, and so the governor is primarily just making a recommendation to the legislature as a starting point for their discussion. So the public would engage in that legislative process. And at this point, with the new legislature coming in, new finance chairs coming in, they're going to, I think fairly soon, probably lay out some expectation of what that public process is going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to be early involvement of the public, or is it going to be something where they'll come up with a straw man proposal that will then be put out for public comment? But that will be determined here shortly.
And when the legislature starts getting together and all of this starts happening, I'm sure we'll be hearing from legislators about what may or may not have happened to some of their pet projects in the budget process. I mean, some people may be, hey, you know, I wanted more money in here for safe water. Where is that? You know, we need to increase that.
Right, and that's all part of that legislative process. What you'll see is the various legislators will both be working on the operating budget, seeing things in terms of various ongoing programs that they'd like to see either more or less money into, but also the capital projects that, you described, either at the community level where they're looking to provide funding for something that's within their particular district or looking at a safe water program or something that they would like to see more money on that gets distributed through some other program.
Mm-hmm. And then there were some new things the governor did. Let's see, there's $2 million for preschool.
Right, that's part
of the... That's extra. I mean, yeah, part of Head Start, but a big boost. I'm sure those people will appreciate that. There's a new emphasis on early childhood education. Of course, as you said, expansion of Denali Kid Care, and then increase for people with intensive needs. What is that?
I believe that's part of the education budget. So that's for students who need particular additional staff support. And it's always an issue between the districts. I'm not fully conversant in this, but the issue about how much is going to be allocated for those particular students is an issue above and beyond just the general formula.
It was interesting talking about the budget over the last few days, and then on the front page of today's paper, it looks like there are going to be some salary increases. The governor gets, at this point, after a salary study, which are becoming pretty common nowadays, it may get a raise. The lieutenant governor gets a raise, and some of the commissioners. What's up with that?
Well, it's actually in the legislature. That's the one that
yes,
you missed.
Yes, yes.
I think actually the motivation probably is mostly the last one with the legislature, because what you find in – and this is to be expected in a public environment. People don't want to be seen as helping themselves or adding something to their own pocket when they're serving the public. And so the legislature and the administration, particularly at the higher levels, the governor and lieutenant governor in particular, are not one to come out publicly and say, hey, I think I need to be paid more. And so there was a bill that was passed last year by the legislature that said, okay, we're not going to put ourselves in the middle of this. We're going to set it off to this commission, and the commission will make their determination. And if we don't act, then what they say will rule. And so that's the process that's begun with this as the first sort of formal public announcement of what they're thinking.
Where do the commissions come from? I've always, you know, wondered that who makes up the commissions that review current salaries and make recommendations for, well, this person might be making too much or this person is making too little.
Well, the commission, this particular commission, each legislative bill that sets up a commission of some sort will identify how its members are going to be appointed. And some are appointed by strictly the governor. Others are appointed by a combination of the governor, the legislature, and some, like I think the redistricting one, has representatives of both the governor, the legislature, and the judiciary. So each one is going to have a different method of appointment. But when you talk about actual state employees, what they're being paid and people identifying what the appropriate amount would be, most of that is actually done internal to the Department of Administration, Division of Personnel. They have folks who do the classification system to identify what the appropriate pay range is for various activities.
And now, as far as revenue sharing for communities, a few years ago that was wiped out, and Governor Palin has been working to get that boosted up again. Where are we at with revenue sharing?
That's basically flat. It's kept the same as what was approved last year. I think it's $60 million that was approved last year, and that's what's being included in the governor's budget for this year.
So as far as – have you had any feedback so far from some of the communities? I'm sure some were already saying through this process we need more, or do they do that at the legislative level?
I think they recognize that it's a legislative issue for the communities to come out looking for particular projects to be funded. I think what I've just heard through the press that probably that you've read is a number of the municipal representatives have said, hey, they're glad to see revenue sharing continued. That is a big boost for their concerns at this time. And then they'll focus on other things with the legislature.
Did I hear somewhere that Anchorage may be able to lower their property taxes a little as a result of the current proposed budget? Or
That's beyond my...
Good grief. Don't you know everything about the city of Anchorage? You should be held responsible. No.
I live here. I get my bill. I pay it. That's fine.
You're listening to Community Forum on KSKA. Today we're talking budgets with Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. 550-8433. Information is available on Governor Palin's homepage. And you can also go to the Office of Management and Budget for the state. It is omb.alaska.gov if you want to take a look at the draft budget bills and information. That's omb.alaska.gov. And give us a call here if you have questions or comments, 550-8433 or 1-888-353-5752. You've been doing a lot of shows in the community. Yesterday you were on Talk of Alaska, and I heard you on some AM stations. What do you do? You know, you disseminate this information, and people who call up and comment, and, you know, do you take that information anywhere? I mean,
well, yeah, we will. If somebody comes in and says, hey, look at this, we'll get on it. You know, these particular call-in shows, depending on how the host manages it, you might not get a whole lot of feedback from individual callers. But, you know, there's a variety of ways in which folks can influence the process. Part of it is just, you know, coming up to us in the street and saying, hey, think about this.
So on the back of your coat, formal. Do you have a big sign that says Revenue Commissioner?
I don't at this time.
Sorry.
Enough attention as it is.
One of the questions that, you know, everybody is concerned about is the refinery at North Pole. Is the governor taking a look at helping them out, or?
Well, the governor's taking a look at that issue. It's a clearly it's an area of tremendous just public interest, because you have these dual concerns of, hey, how come we're paying so much for gasoline compared to the lower 48? What makes us so different, and why does it seem as though those margins between us and the lower 48 have increased over the last few years? And yet at the other side of the coin, you've got the refinery, particularly the one up in Flint Hills owned in North Pole, that's saying we're not making enough profit. We're just struggling, and we're going to have to make decisions about the long-term viability of this operation. So – And the state has a particular relationship with Flint Hills, because it's the crude oil that it uses in the refining process comes from the state. They buy it from the state as part of our royalty share. We take it, rather than taking it in value, we take it in kind and sell it to the Flint Hills folks at a agreed upon price under a contract that was established when they bought out the refinery. And so that contract's getting scrutiny in terms of, is that a fair contract? And so last week, the governor and Commissioner Irwin, Department of Natural Resources, announced that they had reached an agreement with Flint Hills to basically spend the next 3 to 6 months to look closely at the economics of the refinery, look at what the state's role is and what the state's role should be in making sure that that is a profitable, appropriately profitable operation, and that the state residents are benefiting from an efficient operation.
I know that there has been a lot of concern because, as everybody knows, the price of fuel here in Alaska raises up just as fast as the market, but it falls extremely slowly. We're still quite a ways behind other markets. And there was the state took a look at it and said, well, it's the refinery, what they're charging, but it seems to me like when they were proposing to put a refinery in Alaska, they were saying, well, if we have this refinery here, you know, that's going to mean cheaper fuel for Alaskans. Well, that didn't really happen, because they were, of course, you know, they couldn't undercut. They had to work within the market, or whatever voodoo things they say. So can we function without that refinery here in the state? What would a closure of that magnitude mean for us?
Well, that's one of the key issues that they're going to be looking at over the next 3 to 6 months, is what is the ramification of losing a refinery of that nature. We've got, you know, they're producing product, aviation fuel, jet fuel and such, that's needed up in the Fairbanks area for both the airport as well as the military bases. And there's a potential domino effect when you lose a core industry to the other businesses that depend upon that particular product. And the question becomes, what's the alternative? And mm-hmm. what's going to be the market price for that alternative? We obviously are going to pay some form of a premium over what they would pay in the lower 48 if we were transporting it up here, because we'd be paying for that shipping cost. Mm-hmm. And the question becomes, okay, what's a reasonable amount of shipping cost compared to what we're paying for the refined gasoline that we're experiencing now? And are we getting a good deal?
I think the ones that really get nailed are the villages and the communities, and probably even some urban customers that have large storage where they for the most part, purchase their fuel either in the late spring, summer, or they're purchasing it over the summer and have essentially bought at extremely high prices. And now that's the price of fuel that's sitting in their tanks, and that's what they're charging over the winter.
And that's a big problem, particularly this year when we had the price of oil peaked around July 3rd. And for many villages, they were looking at first
people
of July.
Screaming for help.
That was when they were screaming for help, and that was the purpose of the resource rebate. But what you ended up with are people, like you say, who locked in that price by buying their fuel for the entire winter at that particular time. And here we are now 6 months later. The price has dropped $100 a barrel, and mm-hmm. these folks are still having to cover the cost of that purchase. And so it is a difficulty that we face in our villages that have basically these opportunities to buy their fuel, and they're stuck at whatever the price of the moment is. Mm-hmm. And I think we're going to try to look at ways in which we can try to ease some of that on an ongoing basis so that we don't end up with people just basically the crapshoot of what the price happens to be on the date when you're obligated to make the purchase.
Mm-hmm. It seems to me like, you know, we're always going to be in this position until, you know, somehow the bull gets taken by the horns and some kind of alternative to barging fuels at the villages occurs. I mean, we don't have any road system. Is there anybody looking at a long term for that, or are we just going to continue, you know, doing what we're doing as far as lack of infrastructure in the rural areas?
Well, that's the key aspect of the energy blueprint that is being worked on by Steve Hagenson and the folks at Alaska Energy Authority. We've got what Steve's pulling together right now is a comprehensive list of the energy project opportunities at the village level so that each village can look at what they have available to them in terms of resources and what the economics of those choices look like. Mm-hmm. And they can compare them to the diesel alternative at various oil prices so that they can see the trade-off that would exist in their community if they decide to make the investment to pursue a particular energy plan, whether it be a wind or a wood-based or hydro project in their particular region. And the state is going to have to make a decision on a comprehensive basis as to the level of investment we're going to make in those projects. And it's going to be a significant public policy issue over the next year and a half to 2 years as we wrestle with, okay, we saw how bad it could be mm-hmm. this past year. And we kind of have this lull right now where it's not quite the crisis that it seemed to be in the summer. But let's not wait until we're back in crisis mode. Let's see if we can get ahead of the curve and start to move towards alternatives that are not going to subject us to the oil price fluctuations that we've been living with for a generation.
But what are some of those short-term alternatives?
Well, there's – and what Steve is pulling together are short-term, mid-term, long-term mm-hmm. options.
But do I mean does the general public know about them? I mean, is there – like he is saying, well, these villages maybe develop more wind and someone's already – getting in those plans in motion?
And that's that actually you're hitting right on one of the barriers that we've found to the idea of a long-term energy plan for Alaska is that at the village level there hasn't been information about what their alternatives are. And that's what Steve is really working on, is to pull that together so that when it comes back to the village they can say, hey, we've got these four different options. We've got, you know, in our particular area, we can use this biofuel. We can use the wind power. We can use a small geothermal or this hydro. Well, let's look at the efficiency of those. How much is it going to take to get it started? How long is it going to take to get it online? And what's the ultimate cost going to be? And how much? And then they can decide coming forward which one they would want to back.
Mm-hmm.
Come to the state and say, hey, this is the one that we would like to have, and participate in a funding system that would allow them to get the money to get that project started.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to start with information. We need to start with the communities being able to see what their options are, and then have in place simultaneously the ability to have them come forward and say, these are the ones we want to pursue. How do we get our money?
Mm-hmm. It seems to me like there's this whole big ball out there that has jammed up the basket. You know, people, there are certain people who feel, you know, they don't want – I know this is a huge policy question, and I didn't mean to just throw it at you, but since we're talking about it.
Get to be chair of the, I'm chair of the Alaska Energy Authority, so it sort of
here
fits.
You know, people don't necessarily want, you know, big projects in their villages. Maybe they don't want a road to their village, or but yet – how can we deal with these issues if we don't do something about infrastructure? And, you know, people say, well, we want the local control to be able to make this decision. We do or don't want it. It sort of reminds me of some of the communities like Nooksut and Atkinsuk, where they were involved with the Alpine Field, and things are going pretty well with them. They've got local jobs. But other villages say, you know, we don't really want that. And so they're really struggling.
Well, I think that is one of the reasons why I really appreciate the way that this energy blueprint that Steve's putting together is coming to fruition, is that it recognizes that ultimately you need to get the buy-in at the local community level. You can't just come in and say, hey, you're going to get a geothermal project, and have them say, well, wait a second, we don't want to have a geothermal that's right out in our primary hunting area, and that's going to disturb our lifestyle. We'd rather trade off some of the potential efficiency or lack of cost over there into a different type of project that's not going to have the same impact. Well, what Steve's information is going to do is going to provide them with the opportunity to see the options before them, see where those resources are, what areas it's going to impact, and allow them to make the decision, hey, yeah, we were willing to trade off hydro over here because it's in an area that isn't going to impact our lifestyle, and it is going to be a lower cost long-term solution. In the short term, let's work on this biofuel because we've got the resources to do that. And that begins the process of having the local community say, here's what we want to do. They become the advocates for their particular project, and we don't have the state imposing something on these folks and having them end up actually opposing mm-hmm. their own solution.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think we need to get this process past this big lump in the basket, as you say, and the way to break through that is to get information to the local level, allow them to make the selections that then come up to the regional levels, and ultimately mm-hmm. for the state to be able to help whichever area is ready to go.
Mm-hmm. I guess, you know, where I'm getting hung up is that you know, we've been covering these issues for 100 years, and, you know, we're still doing, you know, basically the same, you know, cost of fuel stories that we were doing 20 years ago. And I think, you know, it would be really good to just see something break loose and, you know, something change for a change.
Well, and it's, you know, when a year ago, it seemed as though anything was possible.
Mm-hmm.
And we're
money,
going to
yeah,
have
money
coming
flowing,
out of our ears,
yes.
And we're going to be just
throwing it. It was the governor's dream.
And everything was going to be fundable, and we're going to be able to solve all of our problems simply by throwing money at it. But that easy option, if it were mm-hmm. even going to be successful, is not available to us. We're going to have to make smart decisions. We're going to have to actually make choices. And those choices are not going to be easy.
Mm-hmm.
And a big part of, I think, the long-term discussion as it relates to the villages is kind of where you're going with the combination of infrastructure investment, energy costs, and then lifestyle trade-offs. And at a village level, there's going to be a part of the discussion that's going to be, you know, what's our long-term outlook? What's mm-hmm. what's our plan for our own community? And at the state we're going to be wrestling with some issues that you've also seen, the sustainability of each of the villages.
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting because just a few months ago they were saying, oh, no, people from the bush are moving into Anchorage, they're flooding our schools, and now we've discovered that isn't really happening. But, yeah. You are listening to Community Forum. This is a live call-in program. If you're listening in the afternoon, we're talking about the state budget with Revenue Commissioner Pat Galvin. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. Our number is 550-8433. Our toll-free is 1-888-353-5752. And if that isn't enough information for you, there's also Community Forum at kska.org. If you're listening in the evening, you can't call in because the program has been pre-recorded. Line 5 and Pam, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. And I have a question or a suggestion on this very topic of involving rural communities. And having worked in trying to do that from the grassroots and as a scientist in the unorganized borough, I find that there needs to be a regular public involvement process through the state, which we really haven't had before, even with the governor's rural sanitation commissions. And I would like to suggest that this is something of getting people in rural areas who are working with people there to get information back up to the state rather than just the state down, which doesn't work as well, I don't think.
Well, are you, I mean, is this something that you have practiced and you alluded to, you know, some doing some work out there? Is this something that's uncommon?
In my experience, it's uncommon. It's something I've been doing for a number of years, both in Alaska and also in rural New Mexico. And it's a very different way of involving people directly and also getting on an equal basis with the government or with other agencies. And it's a way of communicating, which is quite different from just having public meetings or having... The communities are not supplicants in the process I would suggest that be used.
Okay, well, maybe we'll see more of that in the future. Thanks for your call, Pam. We're going to ask Commissioner Galvin, is that something that is potential in Governor Palin's administration, constant public input on solving some of these long-term problems?
Yeah, I'd actually say that the way that the energy planning process has been structured by Steve Hagenson and the folks at AEA is really along the lines of the model that Pam just described, where we really are looking to provide both get the feedback initially from those villages and then provide them with the information so that they make the decisions, and that moves up through a decision-making process that starts at the local level, at the village level, comes up through the regional level, and then ultimately to the state, as opposed to a top-down approach. And so it is very much consistent with what Pam's describing.
And as far as the private sector is concerned, have you heard anything from the private sector about, you know, going out and maybe doing something on the Yukon to that might alleviate some of the fuel storage problems or, you know, the price problems, anything like that? I know doing business in rural Alaska, and that's pretty tough.
Well, I haven't heard anything in particular, but I do have some hope that as the information that comes out of that energy blueprint becomes public, what will be available is the economic opportunity that some of these projects would provide. And it's definitely not our expectation that the state is going to fund all these projects mm-hmm. to their full extent, that there's going to need to be both local and private participation in these projects. And when you begin to see that some of these projects actually being able to make money at a reasonable cost to the local consumer, then you can begin to imagine private entities coming in and saying, hey, this is a business opportunity for us. We're willing to step in and be a sponsor of a project such as that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. John on line 2, welcome to the show.
Hello, Mr. Galvin. I've been following this Flint Hills refinery issue for quite a long time, and I'm of the opinion that we're getting scalped as usual on these energy prices.
Uh-huh.
And I would like to know if we could do something along the lines of purchasing the Flint Hills project, Flint Hills pipeline refinery, putting some of our own people in there, learning how to run the place, and using the oil that we have in the form of royalty oil to supply the place and start putting out some reasonably priced oil and oil products that can get our state out from under all this speculation that's going on.
Okay, is that a possibility?
Well, I think that the initial question is going to be, can a private refinery that is getting a reasonable profit survive within the particular environment that we provide up here in Alaska, and does it end up with a reasonable priced commodity that Alaskans basically can live with and also know that they're getting a fair price? I wouldn't jump right to public ownership as being the solution. It hasn't proven to be the solution in too many things of this nature, and particularly something that is potentially in the competitive marketplace. And so I think that the first place that I would start, and that's where the governor and Commissioner Irwin seem to be starting, is to look closely at what Flint Hills operations are like, what their profit expectations and margins are, and then determine if there is a mechanism for the state to assist, alleviate any potential barriers, whether it be the way our contract is structured or other factors in the state Flint Hills relationship that can alleviate that, or is Flint Hills basically operating with unrealistic expectations on either their profit or otherwise, in which case the options will be considered in terms of ensuring that the public interest is preserved, which may end up involving the state taking some role in it. But I think that's a way down the list mm-hmm. option that would be explored.
Doesn't the railroad, their future also hinge on the fuel that they get from the refinery? They're saying, or there was some state organization that said...
The railroad does have an interest in seeing Flint Hills continue, both as a customer of the railroad
and as a
shipper and as a fuel source, I think primarily as the shipper. And so the railroad is very much interested in seeing a solution be developed, and whether they're part of the solution or not is yet to be determined.
Mm-hmm. So Uncle Bill hasn't come up with any suggestions yet. Is he calling you?
I'm not involved, so I wouldn't get the call if he did.
Okay. This is a live call-in program. If you're listening in the afternoon, 550-8433 is the number. Our toll-free 1-888-353-5752. Tim on line 4. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Nellie. So much for keeping the conversation going all these years. You're great. Commissioner Glavin, I wonder if you're aware of if there's any statutory language that might prevent the state of Alaska from building an LNG plant up at Prudhoe Bay and unstrand the gas there, sell it to the highest bidder, and then in the off-season ship it up the rivers to those isolated villages in Alaska and give it to them for free.
There you have it.
That's a big, big mouthful. I guess I'll take it in
separate parts. Can we get your approval right now?
I'm just going to hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll take it in separate parts. The first issue is, ever since we've been talking about a gas line, at least in the last couple of years, with the global warming and the issues of the changing environment on the North Slope, the question's been raised, would it be more efficient to simply build the LNG terminal up there, forget about a pipeline? What we have learned in discussions with folks is that basically the level of investment that would be required, tens of billions of dollars to build a sufficient LNG terminal, would be very risky, given that you'd be basically betting on the acceleration of the climate change. And if it ends up stabilizing or reversing, you'd have a facility that could not operate for a big chunk of the year, given the ice conditions. So as an investment, it may not be the smartest thing to do. From a structural standpoint, the question initially was, is there any statutory prohibition? I think the answer is no, other than you'd have to get the money. The legislature would have to appropriate the money. But then you build it, and you're facing the same issue that we deal with on the pipeline. Do you have customers? The majority of the gas is still subject to the leases controlled by the big three. You'd have to work out an arrangement for them to put their gas into the line, and you'd be dealing with the same issues that we're dealing with on the major gas line that we hear about every day. And then the third one about, can we then produce it and give it to the villages? And the answer to that one is no. And that actually harkens back to the issue we were just talking about with Flint Hills. The contract that I described, where they're using the state's royalty oil for their refining, there's been public discussion, a lot of members of the public saying, hey, why don't we just cut them a cheap deal and give them the oil for $5 a barrel, and then we'll all enjoy gasoline that's, you know, 50 cents a gallon. Well, there's constitutional issues, prohibitions that preclude that kind of an arrangement. Just from the administration standpoint, we don't have the authority to go and sell the oil at a discounted rate. We are obligated to get the same amount that we would get if the oil flowed to market and was sold on our behalf. And so that's the basically the minimal price that we can sell it for if we take the oil in kind.
And that's a constitutional thing?
That's a constitutional thing.
That's on page 86.46.88 of...
Right, article blah, 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 blah.
Okay. And I wanted to ask you, what is the life of a refinery like Flint Hills? And does it become archaic before... global warming really, really, really kicks in. Ta-da. Boy, we're really, really pushing.
Yeah, I was going to say you're beyond that. That
where
that
did you say
into,
you went to school?
That goes into engineering, and that's the one degree I didn't get. So I wouldn't venture to answer that. Although, just to point out, I think from a practical standpoint, the discussion of alternative fuels is one that is going to be a big part of the national discussion as the new administration comes in and talks about moving into a green economy. And I have not heard any suggestion that any of the potential new technologies is ready to step in the near future to where we can already see the end of a fossil fuel-based energy policy. And so I think that it's probably a little premature to be too worried about the refinery becoming obsolete anytime soon. But and that actually in Alaska in particular, given the limitations on some of the non-diesel options that we might be facing. But I think what we're looking at is trying to move Alaska towards a more renewable energy picture so that we don't end up with the Alaska consumption of energy being tied to the same commodity that we're gaining our profit off of. Yeah.
Fossil fuels forever. That's FFF.
We're moving away.
Okay. So that would be Steve Hawkinson. So
that's a big part of Steve Hawkinson's work as well.
So Steve, if you're listening,
keep working.
Get busy.
I drove by and he was working up in his office when I drove by. So
okay. The light was on.
The light was on. Okay. He was busy.
Okay. Pat Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue, is here with us today, 550-8433. Give us a call if you have questions or comments. Dick on line 7, welcome to the show.
Oh, good afternoon. My question goes to the profitability of Flint Hills. And when I hear Flint Hills say they're having trouble making ends meet with the current sales prices, one question that comes to mind is whether their problem is what they paid for the refinery. I know there's been a number of owners prior to Flint Hills, and I've wondered whether the state is looking at their operating profit rather than their net income, which would include their costs of capital to buy the refinery. I note that as of today, the lower 48 wholesale price of gasoline was $1.03. Mm-hmm. And it just boggles my mind to see that we have $1.50 of margin above the lower 48 wholesale prices for local sales of gas. I'll take the answer off the air.
I think we need to call over to Flint Hills.
It sounds like we need to link them in rather than have me try to make up answers. But I, just in response, I'm pretty confident that the analysis will be fairly comprehensive and will include the things that the caller identified.
Okay. And I guess all of that will be coming out in the next few months. I'm sure we'll be hearing.
Yeah, I think there's a 3 to 6 month time frame for doing that analysis.
Since everybody is in a panic about what's going to happen in the next 10 minutes. Okay, we have to talk about TransCanada and what is budgeted as far as gas line is concerned. And are we looking at pumping more money into TransCanada, or just where are we at as far as revenue with the proposed gas line?
Well, as far as revenue on the gas line, that's many years out. But for this particular fiscal year, what we're looking at is about $20 million to continue the reimbursement fund for the AGIA license. TransCanada will move towards an open season, which is where they solicit for commitments on their pipeline in the summer of 2010. So to get us from here to there, we're looking at about another $20 million to be the state's portion of that reimbursement. What we're watching is basically all that we've set the table for the commercial stakeholders of this project to begin to work towards resolution of their issues. With AGIA, it sets the project moving, establishes a time frame that folks have to stick with. And what we're seeing is all of the players are responding to that time frame and moving forward with their analysis so that we can hopefully begin to see some resolution of the issues that have been just talked about for the last few years.
So where are we at right now?
What we have
the gas line.
We have TransCanada doing work. They were spent the summer, the end of the summer after they actually got approval of the license, doing the aerial photography and so forth
field work that they needed to
be able to work at their desks doing the engineering, the initial engineering to plan the field season for next year. We've got Denali, the BP Conoco
they were here
projects,
a few weeks ago. Uh-huh.
And they did their field work in the summer and they continue to build their operation and move their project ahead. Their is basically a lot of momentum on this project that is moving towards, hopefully, a discussion about bringing one project together at the end. Obviously, only one project is going to be built.
Mm-hmm.
We have confidence that the project is fully economic, and so it will generate sufficient interest in those parties that are going to make a lot of money off this project in and of itself, that they will be motivated to find an agreement where there is one to be made. And we'll end the stalemate that we've had for the last couple of years where it's just been, okay, how much is the state going to throw into this and add to the kitty? It's going to be, okay, we see that the state's kind of established what its terms are going to be. Now we'll find where our middle ground is going to be in order to move this project ahead.
Mm-hmm. And is it going to be like called Trans Denali or Denali Canada or?
We'll see how the parties all come together.
Mm-hmm. And how are the parties all coming together at this point? Are you involved in talking to Denali at this point?
Well, Denali's talking to the state about their permitting issues and moving their project ahead. They've said that they will ultimately need to come back to the state with requirements on changes to the fiscal system in order for their project to move ahead, for their potential shippers to be satisfied.
I guess so.
And okay. What we are looking for is basically the producers to recognize, hey, we've got to make a decision. We've got to move forward on this project, and we need to come in with a realistic expectation.
Mm-hmm.
The previous administration, I think, established an unreasonable expectation of what the state was going to be willing to forego and give in for this project. And we basically need to bring that down to a sense of reality for the producers. And we believe that we're moving in that direction. We believe that with TransCanada moving their project ahead with the relatively reasonable cost project that they would bring in, that they will be an attractive opportunity for the producers to participate in once the producers realize that there isn't more at the trough to get from the state.
Mm-hmm. And recently they were talking about maybe getting some federal, more, you know, additional federal guarantees as far as TransCanada was concerned. Is that still happening, or
well,
where are we
a,
at with that?
There's a general recognition that there's benefits for the state, for the federal government, and for the producers if the project were to move ahead. And the question that was raised was, well, if the federal government wants to participate more, what's the type of thing that they could do?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer is, well, one thing they could do is recognize that the loan guarantee was based upon a $20 million or $20 billion estimate, and the estimates have gone up from there. But there is no current requirement of the federal government to do anything in order for this project to work. It works financially, but the question becomes that the federal government wants to push it along,
mm-hmm.
and wants to get it moving quicker than what it would if we waited until the commercial players congealed. What would they be able to do? And I think that's something that's an open question still. What would the federal government be able to do to help move this along?
Mm-hmm.
The state looked at that question 2 years ago and said, AGEA, that's the way what we're going to do to move this project along. And I think the question is one that the federal government, the new administration coming in particular, is saying, okay, what if we wanted to do something? What would we do?
And now you've got, of course, Ted Stevens leaving the Senate, Mark Begich moving in, a lot of stuff going on down there. Are these things, the project still looking pretty stable as far as here at home and here and there and over there? And
yeah, what we're seeing is I think the public's reaction to the change in the oil world is thinking, oh, this means that the gas pipeline gets put on the shelf again. But it turns out that the gas prices are not dropping like oil prices are
mm-hmm.
dropping. And the long-term expectations for gas prices remain about where they were when we were projecting the economic viability of this project
mm-hmm.
last spring. And so the project is still economic.
Okay, you're just going to have to come back next week and talk about how it's still economic some more.
That's Christmas week. I don't think anybody wants to talk gas line during Christmas.
Well, I want to thank you, Commissioner Galvin, for being here today. Interesting conversation. We'll be interested to see how some of those rural issues pan out. And I'll see you again after Christmas.
Thanks, Nellie.
Community Forum is a production of KSKA's News and Public Affairs Department. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write to us. KSKA 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska 99508, or email us at communityforum@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/communityforum. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.